I'm James St. James. This is Night Fever, New York nightlife legends of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, the co-founders of World of Wonder, Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato. It's good to see you both.
Lovely to see you, too.
Lovely to see you, too. Our guest today is an original punk rocker. She is a Warhol superstar. She was the first woman DJ in a club in Manhattan. I think maybe the first woman DJ ever in the club scene. She was a rock and roll groupie in the 60s and 70s and has the stories to tell about it. She was Bowie's manager during the Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane, Diamond Dog era. We'll have to talk about that. She is the author of a mesmerizing book called Lick Me, How I Became Cherry Vanilla by Way of the Copacabana, Madison Avenue, the Fillmore East, Andy Warhol, David Bowie, The Police, and beyond. It's probably my favorite rock and roll autobiography of all time. It grabs you and it never lets you go. I'm so glad to have with us the wonderful, the fabulous, the exciting Cherry Vanilla. Woo-hoo-hoo!
Thank you for the beautiful introduction. I'm just thrilled when anybody likes my book, especially another writer.
You have lived such an incredible life, and I don't know that we're going to be able to touch on everything, but you were born in New York, and you grew up in Woodside in Queens, right?
Right.
And your father was a sanitation worker and a truck driver for a meat distributor. Right. So you said there was always meat on the table and there was always lots of mungo in the house. And I had never heard this word mungo before. And it's my new favorite word. What is it?
It means like roadkill, but for inanimate things, like things you find a radio, but it's broken. But you take it home and you fix it and you give it as a gift or you use it. That's mungo. Good things, repairable things found in the trash. And the sanitation men, of course, were picking up all these things. And my father was very good at fixing anything. He could fix anything. So he used to bring home these objects, record players, radios, whatever, and fix them up. And we'd give them to family and friends or use them at home.
Your mother was a telephone operator at Hotel 14 on 60th Street in Manhattan. Tell us what was in the basement of Hotel 14.
The beautiful Copacabana nightclub.
Right. Now, when you were young, just a child, after your mother's shift ended, you would go down to the basement and you could stand in the sort of the entrance way, the back entrance, and you could watch all these acts, these incredible acts in the 1950s. You talk about Martin and Lewis, Jimmy Durante, Eartha Kitt, Carmen Miranda, Tony Bennett. Do you have actual memories of seeing like Carmen Miranda?
Flashes. I have flashes, you know, because my memory got over the years and my brain hurts like a warehouse. It has too much to store, you know. They just add up. Like I'm at a stage in life now where I'm very selective about what I try to remember, because if I try to remember everything, I can't. Flashes like Carmen Miranda's outfits, the Copa girls, and there were a couple of nightclubs where the girls were doing pastel colors in their hair. That always stuck with me. Yeah.
This is like in the 50s, way before Manic Panic.
The 50s, right.
You've spoken about how even during your punk days, that the Copa still had an effect on you, and that the glamour of the Copa, you loved that look and that feel. Can you just sort of describe a little bit about like the people who went to the Copa and what you saw and what you remember of that era?
Well, you know, fragrance and smells are the first thing I think that come to my mind, because there was a mixture of expensive perfume, not cheap perfume, and the Copa, the food. They cooked like a combination of Chinese and French food. And so That's the first thing that I remember are the smells, the perfume, the food. And then it was the 1950s, so a lot of women were in strapless dresses, so there was a lot of skin, which you didn't see that much of in those days, but, you know, a lot of bare shoulders, which I thought was the most glamorous thing in the world, to have bare shoulders. Oh, my God. And then over the back of their chair would be like a mink stole or some little expensive fur wrap, you know, foxes or something, real fur in those days. And then, of course, the stage was small. I remember the stage being small, and I think each musician had a little music stand in front of them in the band. And the stage was shallow, as I remember, kind of shallow. But they had these Copa girls. I think there were six of them, maybe. And each time a new entertainer came in and did a show, the girls would have different color theme. Like they had mint green costumes, they'd have mint green hair. Larry Matthews, that was the hairdresser. And Larry Matthews was open 24 hours in Manhattan, a hairdresser.
Can you imagine?
Besides prostitutes and showgirls and stuff, whenever there was a wedding in the family, and especially Catholic, because they'd often be a mass at 10 o'clock in the morning, we had to go get our hair done somewhere at like 5 a.m. So that's where we went, was to Larry Matthews. So that was my glamour, was the Copa girls and how they achieved their looks. And, you know, Carmen Miranda, of course, with her head wrapped up. And I had never been used to turbans and things like that either. That was exotic to me in Queens.
Oh, yeah.
Queens was totally Irish and German then. I remember when the first Italians moved in. They came from Italy. Oh, my God. And I was so thrilled. So anyway, that's like how I, and of course the men, you know, the grooming, they all had, you know, that Dean Martin kind of black, shiny hair. It seemed good haircuts and, or, you know, blonde, but they, white crisp shirts and tuxedos. It was very,
that's so sexy.
Big night out to go to the Copa, always a big night out. It was always expensive, you know, for a family. So it was a very, very glamorous situation. And it was nothing like my family situation in Queens. So it's where I saw the difference between how we lived and how the richer people lived, you know what I mean? Or the right. Show people.
I want to skip a little bit into the 60s when you are a young woman and you sort of fall into the advertising agents on Madison Avenue. This is sort of like the Mad Men era. Did Mad Men get it right? Was it as crazy, as nutty as all that?
You know, they actually did, because over time, I think people assumed that the psychedelic LSD era came more from the San Francisco area.
Like Haight-Ashbury, yeah.
But really, my first exposure to it, even hearing about it, was on Madison Avenue in the advertising agencies. Everybody knew about psychedelics and mushrooms and peyote. And I started taking it when I was 17, when I got my first job on Madison Avenue. I didn't even know. In my second job, where I was like 19, everybody I worked with in the department was gay except me.
This is at Kester Hilton, right?
That was at Kester Hilton, yeah.
Kester Hilton, yeah.
The first agency was Sullivan, Stauffer, Colwell, and Bayliss, and they advertised Noxzema and Lipton Tea and all that. And they were straight guys, and I was going out with all of them I could go out with. And but when I hit Kester Hilton, you know, I was so naive, if you can believe this, that I didn't know girls could be gay. I thought gay was only for boys. So now I was in Kester Hilton, where both the boys and the girls were gay. And that opened up another whole thing to me, you know. And I was so young, but I never felt like, oh, I'm a woman, it's going to be harder for me. No, I didn't. I felt like, boy, am I lucky. Am I lucky? Look at me, where I am. I was 19 and this producer, casting director left and gave me her office. 19, I had my own office with a window on Madison Avenue. You know, they raised my pay from $60 a week to like $85 a week, which was insane, you know? Now, Madison Avenue, when they did their LSD thing.
Well, it, you know, it totally makes sense that, like, when you think about the commercials in the 1960s, that everybody was on acid in LSD because they were just, it totally, it's one of those things, oh, of course, everybody was out of their minds.
The only thing, though, I think when they did it on TV, everybody stayed in their suits and shirts and stuff. I remember thinking, no, we were on Fire Island. We were naked. We were in teeny bikinis. And, you know, I thought we didn't do trips and stay in, you know, suits and ties and you know, sheath dresses and high heels.
You talk about a lot of the orgies and the LSD orgies and the whipped cream orgies and everything that you had on Fire Island. And Fire Island in those days seems like it wasn't a gay, it wasn't the gay mecca that it is now, that it was a lot of just Madison Avenue people out there going bananas on the weekends.
Well, each community on Fire Island had its own personality. The Pines and Cherry Grove were gay. Cherry Grove right. was kind of lesbian more than gay. The Pines was more gay than lesbian. Then there were communities that were family communities where you, people could actually take a Jeep across and be, live there in the winters. And then there was Ocean Ridge was advertising and Davis Park was advertising. And they were almost one community right next to each other and very not gay. Or so I thought. Half the boys I was, you know, having sex with turned out to be gay a couple of years later. But anyway, not saying much for my sex, but I started out in the advertising sort of community, Davis Park, Ocean Ridge. And as I met more and more people, they took me down to the Pines. And so that's where I met a lot of gay people. And I also realized that the Pines seemed a lot more glamorous than Ocean Ridge and Davis Park. I kind of liked it better. So I started hanging out there, which meant I started hanging out really in the gay community, the gayest. And that had a big influence on my sexuality because I was following what the gay boys were doing, which was breaking ground and breaking rules about sex, you know? So that made me kind of very promiscuous and also introduced me to a lot of incredible creative people. Unfortunately, a huge wave of them died in the first bout of AIDS, you know? Oh, promising young people that I met in the Pines. Dancers, singers, actors, directors, designers, artists, oh, gone, you know? But that was my introduction step-by-step to glamorous life. And I never was greedy. I never wanted to have more house than I could clean or, you know, more money than I could count. But I did want to have that more glamorous life. I was determined about that, whether it was as a hippie or a queen, you know.
You talk a little bit about becoming more promiscuous as the 60s go on. And at this time, you're discovering Cafe Agogo down in the Village, Club 82 in the Bitter End to see Nina Simone. And tell me a little bit about the club scene in those days.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I went to the 82 Club for my, I think it was my 17th birthday. I went with my advertising agency, Sullivan Stauffer boyfriend and his brother and sister-in-law. And the 82 Club then was staffed by, you know, transsexual. I think a lot of early transsexuals, not just drag queens. And the performers, I mean, I remember this sort of kind of hefty woman, and she sang, "Please, Mister, Don't Touch My Tomatoes." And she had a red dress, like she was almost like an early divine, you know, a red dress trimmed in plastic tomatoes.
So she looked like a tomato.
Yeah, right. And they gave knockers. Instead of applauding, you banged your knockers on the table and they'd say, "Okay, ladies, put your knockers on the table," you know? And I thought the 82 Club was like, wow, this is the coolest ever. And then by the same token, I used to go to a place called Le Club. My first apartment was on 55th Street between Sutton Place and First Avenue, and right down the street towards Sutton Place was this little intimate French club, the first discotheque I ever heard of in New York, called Le Club. And you would go there. Donald Trump used to go there. But you would go there and you would have a beautiful French dinner. And then as the music got a little louder and the nights got a little later and the lights got a little lower, you would dance to something new in a club. A guy playing records. I mean, before that, you either danced to a jukebox or a live band, as far as I knew. So this was a discotheque. And so I went there on a lot of dates. And then I started going to the Village all the time, like, because I loved musicians, folk singers, blues singers. I was madly falling in love with John Hammond Jr. and his blues. And so I'd go to the Bitter End and Café Wa. I even played hooky in high school at the Café Wa in the daytime because that was open in the daytime. And there was a guy named Tommy Ray and his Steel Winds electric drum, whatever. And they played those kettle, those drums that they carve out in the islands, you know. And they were open in the daytime. I used to go there and have like vanilla ice cream sodas and talk with Tommy Ray and the musicians who hung out there. So it was a combination of Greenwich Village, Uptown, which was soon I was going to, there were going to be more clubs like Opus followed Le Club, and I became the DJ at Opus. It was still an intimate setting, an Uptown intimate setting.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Opus because, first of all, it means like of the flea, which is like flea market, right? Yeah. And the catch was, the hook of it was that everything in the club was for sale.
That's right. That's right. Everything, the chairs, extra chairs, they used to hang on the ceiling like the Shakers did on the walls, you know. And if you needed an extra chair at your table, you pulled one off the wall because it was a small place. Or if you liked the chair, you could buy it and take it home. You had to get it home yourself.
Like the silverware, the chandelier, like the tables, everything was for sale.
Everything was for sale. Yeah, everything was for sale. And that was also a place where you could have dinner. Nilo DePaul owned it and he had been to the culinary arts. He had been to design school in Paris. He was a man of all trades. He made incredible clothes. He opened Opus. He was a fabulous musician himself. He could do everything. So he cooked French meals, and it was the same idea like Le Club. The lights went down, the music got louder. And there was a guy named Jay Martin. When I first started going to Opus, and was the DJ, and we all smoked pot in those days, so I would offer to Jay that I would man the turntables for a while so he could go off and have a joint, and I loved it so much, and he liked having the breaks, and so he started giving me a few of his nights to do, and I became the DJ at Opus.
Do you think that you were the first woman DJ on the planet?
I don't know. I think so.
I think so, too. I don't think during that period there was anybody else anywhere. I think that you were the first.
You know, I made $50 a night. But to me, that was great because it was an extra job because I still always did production jobs, whether freelance or I had a few long-term ones in ad agencies and TV production houses and things like that. So I advertised the fun part of my life, but you know, I had a kind of work ethic instilled by my parents that, you know, if you wanted an apartment, even if it was one room on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, you better have two or three jobs. So I paid for my freedom by working hard, but I loved every job I had. I loved it.
Quickly, I want to mention some of the people that came into Opus. Salvador Dali, Nureyev, Jackie Kennedy, Zeffirelli, Scavullo, Judy Garland, Miles Davis. It was a very chic place, but then it also had sort of like a drug dealer vibe to it, too. And and the beautiful people were all there. I mean, the waiters and waitresses were the hottest people on the planet. Am I right?
Yeah, they were handpicked by Nilo. You had to be gorgeous, you know. But it's so funny because, you know, drug dealer vibe, it was beyond that because there was a woman there. I'll leave her nameless, but she probably doesn't care anymore. Okay, her name was Loretta. And beautiful, big, beautiful woman. And she had like two or three gorgeous children with her gorgeous husband. And I didn't even know it at the time because I didn't want to know, I guess. But apparently, as I found out years later, she was running a very expensive call girl service from Opus, where she was posing as, or whatever, a tarot card reader. So, you know, it was a very interesting scene there. Very interesting.
There was a club that you mentioned that I'd never heard of that I think is absolutely fabulous called Cerebrum. It was a pleasure dome for trippers is what you called it. And there was no alcohol and you just tripped.
Yeah, it was like you went to the door, you took off your clothes, you put on a long white flowing gown robe, and the whole place was white carpeted platforms that interconnected. And they were about, I'd say two feet, 3 feet off the floor. And you, the patron, sat on the white carpeted platforms, and the beautiful people, also beautiful there, all the waiters, waitresses, whatever you want to call them, they were, forgot what they were called, but they walked around on the floor, so the platforms were up around their thighs or something, and they brought you little things to drink, to taste, because don't forget you were tripping, so if somebody brought you a little slice of an orange or a candy or a little taste of honey, wow, it was fabulous, and they'd bring you a little drink, and they'd bring you a little toy to play with, a fan, a rattle, a little musical instrument, and that's where you had your LSD trip. You stayed there for like 6-7 hours until you were coming down from your trip, and then you went somewhere and had breakfast or whatever.
But there were like glowing orbs and sound effects and lights and everything that would. So you were constantly bombarded.
It did. It rained on you at one point. Beautiful scents were shot out over incense and stuff. The sun came out. The stars came out. The room got dark. A big parachute came out that you could play under. You could throw a beach ball around. It was fabulous. You know, now that psychedelics are almost legal again, somebody should open a club just like that. I'm sure they will.
I think we can do it in the gallery. I think we can do it in the WOW gallery.
Yes, let's do it.
A one-off happening, that's for sure. So
we're going to bring you in to recreate it.
Cerebrum. Oh, you know who I took there on an LSD trip?
Who?
Cousin Brucey.
I remember Cousin Brucey.
ABC AM radio. He's still alive. I was cheating with him on his wife, and I was a friend of his wife's too. And she always used to say, "That perfume of yours smells very familiar." I think she knew. I think she kind of let him play or something.
Oh, because your perfume was all over him when he would go home at night?
Well, I think they had an arrangement or something, you know. But I took Cousin Brucey, who was like the world's squarest DJ in a way. What a wonderful one. ABC AM was my first station I listened to as a child. And I took him to Cerebrum, and I gave him acid.
Before there was Tinder and Grindr and social media, you came up with a wonderful way of picking up people. You went to Tiffany's and you had an elegant little card made up that said what?
It had in one corner, "You are beautiful," and in the other corner, "So am I." And in the middle, it had my name, Kathy Doherty. At that time, I was still going by Kathy Doherty, and my phone number. And I would see like a gorgeous guy on the bus or something. And I'd think, oh, I'd love to know that guy. I'd love to fuck that guy. And I thought, why let the chances go by? So before I get off the bus, I'd hand him the card. And I would say a good 60, 70% of the people I gave the card to called me.
So you would just wander around. You'd be in Central Park on the bus in the subway, and you would just find hot guys and give them this card saying, you're hot, so am I.
Right.
Let's do something about it.
I guess I was an early, you know, socially connected chick.
That could still work today. I think that a return to that would also be a good idea. But, of the 60, 70% that called you, how many did you complete with? Like, of those 60, 70%, did you fuck them all or only some came through?
Well, I either did or I tried. I didn't keep count of that. I don't remember, but I had a lot of sex with a lot of new guys through that, you know?
Gotta get some cards printed, James.
Right.
They must be from Tiffany's, darling.
It had to be from Tiffany. Got to keep it elegant. Got to keep it classy.
That was a good trick I did. Uh-huh.
Yeah, you knew what you were doing. You were on it. Let's go ahead to when you start performing with the Ridiculous Theater in the early 70s. You did, what was it, World? What was that? Was that your first big one?
Yes. I was DJing in Opus. And a friend of mine named David Taylor, who was the assistant to Robert L. Green, who was the fashion director at Playboy magazine. They were friends of mine. David Taylor came in one night and said, come downtown with me after work because I'm going to audition for a play and I think you should do it too. And I was like, well, I'm not an actress. And he said, no, they don't particularly want actors and actresses. They want characters. They want people who can kind of be themselves on stage. So I don't know if we went late that night after my shift, but eventually we got down to the Lower East Side. And, of course, David was dressed in an Italian suit. He was, you know, fashion director assistant at Playboy magazine. And I was, you know, dressed in nightclub DJ gear. And I used to actually dress a lot like sort of Ali McGraw in those days. People, I was kind of preppy because of the advertising jobs, I guess. And I was just getting more and more psychedelic in my looks. But when we entered that filthy old building down on First Street, was it, in the East Village, and went up those stairs, it was so funny because it reminded me so much of the dancing school I went to as a child, Miss Betty Watson's, and going up the stairs, there was a smell, maybe it was rosin or something, there was a smell of dancers or dancing shoes or something in the air, sweat, maybe it was sweat, and it was fabulous, I loved it, I felt, wow, this is so cool, and we got up there, and there was Tony Ingrassia, who weighed a lot of pounds, maybe 300 or 400, I don't know. He was huge. And then there were all these beautiful people. It was Tony Zanetta, Wayne County, these twin boys, and I can't remember all the names now. But anyway, all these beautiful actors and actresses. And so we looked like strangers from a strange land in a way, David and I going there. And I thought, oh, you know, they're never going to want us. Look at them and look at us. You know, they were wild. Lee Childers already had blue hair, blue streaks. Nobody did that then because, except Larry Matthews and the Showgirls, but he did it with magic markers. Street people didn't do it yet, but he did. So they were ahead of us, you know, we felt, but we also thought maybe they don't want us. But right away, Tony Ingrassia was like, take your clothes off. Well, I wasn't shy about that actually. And I never thought I had a great body. I had a weird body, but I had taken my clothes off a lot on Fire Island already. So every show he put me in naked. Tony, I don't know what he was doing. That was the audition. I mean, I didn't even have to audition. It was just like you're in, you know. And the first play I did was The Birth of a Nation by Wayne County back then, now Jane County. World, The Birth of a Nation. And Jane had put this together strictly from song lyrics. Every line of dialogue came from a song. And she attached them all together and made this play out of it, which I have no idea what it was about. The closest I could ever get was it was a male abortion ward on another planet. And somehow Jefferson was there. I don't know. It mixed time zones. It mixed civilization. It was crazy. But everybody had started taking LSD in those days, or at least they were smoking pot. So the audiences that came back again and again because they got so many laughs out of it and got so transported by it that it became like going to see, you know, Monterey Pop on acid, which I did 100 times because of the music. So it became a real happening, and it was cheap. I think it cost $2 or something to go see it. So Andy Warhol came and he saw me doing that, and that's how I got to be in Pork and blah, 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 blah. But that was the beginning of my theater life, yes. Wayne County's World, The Birth of a Nation.
You're sort of an it girl because of this, and you'd been to Max's Kansas City, but you hadn't been in the back room yet, and now you are allowed into the inner sanctum, and this is sort of during the Warhol, Candy Darling, Jackie Curtis, Hollywood Lawn era, am I right? Everybody is there.
Oh, yeah. Jane Fonda. Like Fire Island having, like, each community having its own sort of personality, Max's Kansas City was kind of a little microcosm of that because it had its sections. For instance, you walked in, there was the bar on the left. Some people just hung out at the bar, but not many. Then beyond the bar, toward the back room, you had the advertising professional Madison Avenue Plus crowd over there who mostly came for dinner, be it early or late. Then as you walked past that toward the back room, on the opposite side of that was a partition. And behind that partition was a narrow space that were the serious artists, you know, de Kooning and Pollock and whoever came there, the serious artists. So if you went through the middle of those sections, then you came upon the coffee machines, the bathrooms, and the back room. And the back room opened up, and it was all red neon, lit with red neon and red booths. And as soon as anybody walked into the back room, everybody in there looked up at them. So you couldn't make a quiet entrance because everybody looked. And they looked with that look of, if you don't belong here, don't come in. kind of thing. It was like a velvet rope before the velvet rope. You could really feel the vibe. So I might have gone and looked in there a couple of times and felt the vibe, like, don't come in here, you're in your advertising clothes. We don't want you. Ally McGraw kind of thing. I don't know. But when I met Tony Zanetta and Jane and all the people from World, they hung out there. We hung out at Phoebe's, which was closer to the theater where we were working.
On 4th and Bowery, yeah.
Right. We hung out.
Yeah, I live next door to Phoebe's. I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, it was great. And then we hung out at Max's. And they escorted me into the back room because they were already accepted there and knew everybody there and so forth. So that was my introduction into the back room of Max's. And once you got in, you wanted to go there like every night because, I don't know, you wanted to check in. And it was the kind of place you could go alone. Even as a woman, you felt fine stopping in by yourself because there'd always be somebody there you knew if you wanted to sit down and have a drink with them or not. Or you just go in and see what the latest news was and on your way home. So all of those things are so important. I hope somebody makes a movie where they really incorporate New York and the importance of those different elements in those days, you know, from Cousin Brucie on AM, ABC radio, to the Copacabana, to Max's Back Room and Phoebe's and Lower East Side Theater, because I've never seen one that gave, you know, the whole scene the right color, you know? That's why I'm doing these podcasts. For a while, for many years, I didn't do much of anything publicity-wise, but I want people to explore those things and not have those memories forgotten. When I wrote my book, I had a lot of problems with the editor, because the editor, the final editor I got, was in her 20s. And
you have to teach the kids that every generation, you have to re-educate everybody about the town, or it gets lost.
I think from a movie point of view, Cherry, your story is a challenge because it's such a vast story. You know, just in the last few minutes of us talking, you've connected this with this, with this, with this. Like, there's about 10 lifetimes packed in. And the way you move from one scene to the other, it's epic.
It's a mini series. It's a mini series.
Yeah.
So let's move on to Pork, because you were not in the New York version of Pork that was there. But then when it moved to London, that's when they asked you to be a part of it. And you had to audition for Andy. Tell me about auditioning for Andy Warhol. What happened?
It was fantastic. It was nothing that I expected. Tony Ingrassia, the night before, went over a scene with me from Pork, because he thought maybe Andy would want us to read a scene from the play. And it was a beautiful spring day, as I remember. And the factory at that time was right across from the park, you know, there at 14th Street and Fifth Avenue.
In Union Square, yeah.
Yeah, Max's Kansas City was right around the corner on Park Avenue. And I remember I had been to that factory, I think, only once before. And that was to see a movie screening. I remember Joe D'Alessandro was running the projector. It was like, I don't know, one of their movies. I think that was the only time I had been to the factory before that. And so Tony Ingrassia took me up, and my nerves were, you know, I was excited beyond belief. I mean, you know, this was Andy Warhol, and I had done one play by this time, and I had two lines in it. And Andy saw me, and he asked for me to replace the girl who was doing the part of Pork in New York, because she was a real professional Broadway actress. And just like Theater of the Ridiculous that Tony did, you know, on the Lower East Side, he didn't want a real Broadway actress for this either. And so Andy Warhol didn't really want it. So I was just, you know, being cast as who I was. And what he was most interested in, he didn't ask us to do a scene at all. And what he was most interested in, Andy, was Catholic school. Because he was a really devout Catholic. Don't ask. Anyway, so was I. But he wanted to know a lot about all-girl Catholic school and what that was like. He wanted to know about advertising and my time on Madison Avenue and what that was like. And that's what we really discussed. We didn't discuss anything about the play.
But he wanted you to sing hymns, old Catholic school hymns that you remembered.
Basically, he was saying, well, I like her. Tony is saying right in front of me, I like her. Anyway, like I was, you know, a piece of art or something, which I was. That's what I treasure in life, is that now and forever, I am, you know, a piece of Andy Warhol art. I have no money. I am a piece of Andy Warhol living art. He chose me, you know. So anyway, Tony Ingrassia said to Andy, is there anything you'd like us to read from the play? And Andy said to me, do you know any hymns from Catholic school? And that was shocking, unexpected. And so I said, well, the only one I really liked and remembered was Dear Lady of Fatima. Don't ask me to sing it now, please. And he just, he sat very, you know, rapt attention, and I must have sung it terribly. I mean, I'm not a great singer, and I was a cappella, and God knows what it sounded like. Maybe the worse it was, the better it was for Andy. I don't know. Because at the end of it, he goes, well, I think you got the part. And he said, Tony, you got the part. So that's how I got the part, by singing Dear Lady of Fatima, ultimately. And by just being who I was, I fit what Andy had in mind. Because it was Bridget Polk I was playing, Bridget Berlin.
Oh, right. So Pork is basically Andy and Bridget every day would have conversations that they would tape record, and they sort of strung these tape recordings together to make the play. And that's sort of, so you were playing the Bridget Berlin part.
Right. Bridget Berlin, Bridget Polk, which became Pork.
Bridget Polk, because she poked herself, yes.
One of her other names beside Berlin was Polk, P-O-L-K.
Right.
And she poked, P-O-K-E-D, herself, yes. So I don't know how she poked herself right through her jeans. Anyway, I was playing her, and Andy saw some similarity between us, even though she came from a wealthy, sophisticated family. But she was Catholic, I guess, was she? I don't know.
Yeah.
As I said, that Ally McGraw thing that I had going in those days, a lot of people thought I was a very rich girl for some reason. And I was so stupid and so naive and so unsophisticated. I don't know. I didn't try. I think it's because I played it so innocent. Maybe they thought I was playing it innocent, but I was playing innocent. Honestly, I was innocent. So for some reason, he saw me as like this, I don't know. He saw me as similar to her. And when I met her years later and she was doing her needlepoint and at a charity event, I was like, my God, she's a fine Upper East Side lady. You know? But she had been wild, of course, in the Warhol days.
So you go then to London and you're in pre-production, and Pork becomes a huge deal in London. And you are basically the it kids, you and Jane County and Tony. And there was something like with liquid cocaine that they would put in your mouth because you were losing your voice. What was that? Tell me about that.
Well, at that point in my life, I had never taken any singing lessons or anything. So the Roundhouse Theater in London is a roundhouse where the trains used to turn around, or the trolleys. And we didn't have any microphones. And we were on a big open stage, just, and all the surfaces were hard, just the back, and it was big open, one big open scene with a bed in the middle where I did most of my acting, all of my acting, and a chair with Tony and stuff. Anyway, you had to really project your voice. I had only done one play at this time, and here I was in this round theater making it difficult, no microphones, none of us had, and they had to project my voice to the back of that place. So I was always going hoarse, and I was in like every scene. So I had pages and pages and pages of dialogue. By the way, dialogue taken from those telephone tapes you'd mentioned between Andy and Bridget, which was 1 minute talking about speed, the next minute talking about your abortions, the next minute talking about your mother's tea party on Park Avenue. So trying to memorize that kind of dialogue, which I had never had to memorize any dialogue in my life. Now, it was a huge challenge for me. And so they got this doctor who came, and he had this yellow spray, and I got it in a beautiful little glass vial with a old-fashioned sprayer on the end, silver. Oh, it's fantastic. You know, London. And I would spray that in my throat whenever I needed it, which was for me, all the time. I needed this little thing. And if I didn't have it before going on stage, I panicked, like, I'm going to go out there and I have no voice, because literally a couple of times I completely couldn't make a sound. So, of course, our wonderful friends who we shared an apartment with over there, they all wanted some of this spray when they found out the main ingredient was cocaine. So, Via Valentina especially, she was a real druggie. She was on Mandrax all the time. We all kind of were, but she was heavy. And so she used to steal my, because I'd leave it in the dressing room, and she used to steal my spray, my throat spray.
In a world full of straight people, aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
That would make me go nuts, you know, nuts. Because the fear, like, I can't go out there without my throat spray, you know. Anyway.
Without my liquid cocaine.
my liquid cocaine. And I was never even a cocaine head, really. But the fear, it was the only thing that sort of opened up my throat. Then later on in life, I took some singing lessons and learned how to project, you know. A little bit late, but...
Before it opens, I think you and Liebeck Childers see a poster for David Bowie in like the subway or something, and you decide that you're going to go see him, you're going to go meet him at this performance.
Right. Lee had heard of him. I never had, but Lee had heard of him when a few years earlier he had come to New York and did just a promotion, a radio promotional sort of tour, just him alone. And still was a little notice in some magazine, Rolling Stone or something. And I guess the picture in the dress was in there. So Lee already knew and was curious about him. So when we saw this poster, I think it was on a light post near a bus station we waited at to go to the Roundhouse for our rehearsals. Whatever, we have to go see this guy. He's so interesting. He's so beautiful, blah, 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 blah. So we found out he was playing at a little club at the edge of London called the Country Club, kind of in the border of the suburbs, I guess. And being the pushy Americans we were and the actors we had all these English record companies and PR people believing that, you know, we were there doing pork, but we were writing these columns for Lisa Robinson's magazines and Cream, and which a bit of that was true. Lee's pictures were getting in there, and I was writing a column or and an article or two for those magazines. But not every gig that we got in for free, because we'd say that, did we actually get stuff done and published. So we were lying a little. But they were so polite that they would actually send a car for us, you know, half the time. Anyway, we got out there to the Country Club, and it was a tiny club, still a little bit transitioning, I think, from hippie days. Everybody was sitting on the floor, and the stage was small. I think there was an upright piano, a couple of stools. So we went in there, Jane County, and Lee and me. I think that was it. And Angie Bowie was doing, I don't know, lights and sound or lights. So we went and introduced ourselves to Angie. And of course she was like, oh, darlings, you must come backstage after and see David. He's dying to meet you, of course, and blah, 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 blah. You know, Angie, she could make friends with anybody in an instant, you know. And so during the set, they came out. It was Rick Wakeman on the upright acoustic piano, Mick Ronson on an electric guitar, and David Bowie on an acoustic guitar. And David had the long, wide, voile, what do you call that kind of shiny material?
Oh, like a voile, or yeah.
pants on, yellow Mary Janes, a beautiful loose shirt with big sleeves, white, I think it was white, and a floppy hat with a feather in it, and long, beautiful blonde hair hanging down. And they did a couple of tunes that they were working on at the time. They had already finished the Hunky Dory album, so they did a lot of those songs, which they could do with the acoustic and stuff, but the newer songs that they were working on were for Ziggy Stardust, and they needed a drummer and bass player and stuff for that, but they did like a couple of things. But anyway, during the set, they did Andy Warhol. So when he introduced the song, David asked us to stand up and take a bow. So Jane and I don't think Lee stood up. He was so, because we were the actors, he was tech, you know. But Jane and I stood up, and I popped out a tit because it was a gesture I did over and over in the play, like Bridget Berlin used to do. And that was the first time David got to actually see us, you know. He was on the stage and we were in the audience. And so naturally we went backstage and we made friends. And then I was all hot for Mick Ronson, who I never had sex with in the end. But and then we went to, I think we went to Yours and Mine down on the King's Road, a discotheque that was sometimes, some nights gay, some El Sombrero one night, Yours and Mine another, some nights straight, some nights gay. I don't know. It was all mixed up. But we went and we danced and we hung out, and then we all became friends, and we'd go over to their house for tea sometimes, and that's how we all got to know each other, and that's how Tony DeFreeze got to know us.
When you come back after Pork, you start working at Main Man, which was the company that represented Bowie, right?
Right.
What did you do at Main Man? How did you promote Bowie during this time? Because like when Ziggy Stardust came out, it only got to like 73 on the charts, didn't it? It didn't really take over in America the way that it did in the UK. How did you help?
Well, that's the whole thing right there, because by this time, especially gay boys and any the hip community, David Bowie was already famous to the hip community by this time. And it's absolutely true. I think it wasn't until like Let's Dance or Young Americans or something that he had huge amount of record sales. Right. So he became famous through my publicity, darling. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing, to tell you the truth. I knew advertising, but I didn't know publicity. But I found publicity fascinating, because whereas you could spend $10,000 for a half a page of advertising, you didn't have to pay anything for publicity. You could get five pages and pictures. And I thought that was amazing that you could get all that. So I was fascinated by publicity. I didn't know the rules, so I didn't have any rules to follow. And I took chances, and they paid off, you know. They just paid off who I spoke with, and where I allowed interviews and didn't allow interviews. Now, Tony DeFreeze and David were very clever, and they created a scene that I had to carry out where David wasn't available to anybody. He had two bodyguards, but there wasn't that many people wanting him yet. You know what I mean? So everything was an illusion. Everything was showbiz. I think Main Man is the only management company that has as many famous characters in it as it does. I mean, still, in 2023, I get notes from younger generation people who know all about Tony Zanetta, Jane County, Dana Gillespie, Jamie Andrews, Cliff Jar. How many management company employees are kind of have that degree of fame, you know? I think it's kind of, the Main Man story alone is a very interesting story, the backstory of David Bowie. But anyway, so it was as if a moment had come together where my acting experience, my Madison Avenue experience, my writing experience, even my groupie experience, it was all coming together. And I found this gem called David Bowie. And I found him along with my friends doing Pork before a lot of people in America had found him, before a lot of people anywhere had found him. So I felt like I could now take all of my knowledge and put it into this product, this artist who I could also hopefully have sex with, because that's what I wanted the most, you know. Yeah, I mean, truth be told.
But you do have sex with him, though. You do eventually
a few times
become lovers as well as working buddies.
Well, we became lovers of spending time with each other more than sex, because it was those nights sitting up talking with him that are the most meaningful in my memory, when he was doing a lot of cocaine and he was very imaginative and very interesting, you know, and very talkative. But the sex was great too, so I'm not knocking that.
But he would come over and you would just play records for day, like, you know, for 24 hours, you would just sit and talk music with him. And
yeah. The Ohio Pierce, Skin Tight, that was one of his favorite tracks. The Newport Jazz Festival, I forgot what year, 68 or something. That was one of his favorite albums I had. Yeah, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. What can I say? It was the most magical, magical moment. And he became a huge star.
So there was a story that you tell in your book that just cracked me up about how you guys had rented a suite at the Plaza, and Bowie runs in with Mick Jagger and Bette Midler, and they lock themselves in a closet.
Yeah, that's exactly true. They were such cokeheads at the time. They wanted their private space to do their coke. You know, they weren't going to share it openly in the hotel room. So they went in the closet, and, you know, then they were holding the closet doors closed. They wouldn't let anybody else in. And I think we were saying, it's Rudolf Nureyev. It's Rudolf. He wants to get in, you know. I don't even remember. You know who's good with the memory? You should ask Tony Zanetta about that, because he was there.
Wait, is Tony Zanetta still around?
Yes.
He is. Because Tony is one of those names that comes up over and over and over again in these. Tony Zanetta, Tony DeFries, and Tony Ingrazia are the three Tonys I hear about all the time.
Well, you got to do a show with him, haven't you?
No. I'll have to get his contact from you.
Listen, he didn't take as many drugs as I did. So all the eras and questions you're asking me, I had to ask Tony them when I was writing my book a lot of the time. Say, Tony, do you remember that this person says I did such and such? He goes, yeah, don't you remember? He has a much better memory.
I will definitely contact him.
Definitely.
Your first performance, I think, maybe is Cherry Vanilla, or where you're starting to get your cabaret together, is at Reno Sweeney, and you open for Holly. Hollywood Lawn is doing her famous gig at Reno Sweeney's. Tell us a little bit about Reno Sweeney and about how you went about becoming the chanteuse.
Well, like the Copacabana in a way, Reno Sweeney's was it was quite expensive to go out for a night at Reno Sweeney's. It was a real cabaret. A beautiful one. Louis Friedman owned it, and he was a performer himself, and he wanted everything to be really quality, the sound, the stage, the piano, the lighting. So it was a quality cabaret. And my friend David Smith, he was the bartender there at the time, and David was more than a bartender. He was also a bartender. He was the doorman and manager of Opus. He was a nightclub guy. he was the guy you wanted at the door, behind the bar, letting people in. You know, David Smith is notorious. Anyway, so we had our friend David at the bar, and we were friends with Lewis, who owned the place, and we went there to see different people. I mean, Quentin Crisp did a night there. They had, maybe Patti Smith played there, but I'm not sure. But they had, what I'm trying to say is they had poets, they had comedians, they had chanteuses, they had Broadway, rock and roll, whatever. But you couldn't have drums or serious electric bass or drums. So anyway, I did a poetry reading for my birthday at a little restaurant, Ratazzi's, where the advertising people ate, Ratazzi's. Upstairs had a private room, and I did a birthday reading. First, after I wrote my first Pop-Tart compositions book, I did my first reading there because I figured it was my birthday, so people would be invited. They'd get fed for free, and they, you know, would couldn't boo me. So I did my little first reading, and I loved it. And that was really my first sort of cabaret performance. And so I decided that's what I wanted to do. So I went to Lewis Friedman at Reno Sweeney and asked him if I could play there. I mean, I was ballsy. I didn't really have an act yet, or, you know, all I had done was my little birthday party. And so he said, yeah, how many songs do you have? And I said, oh, I only have like three because I'm just starting. I didn't have any, no songs. But I thought if you didn't have songs, you weren't going to get the gig, you know what I mean? Because it was a big grand piano.
Fake it till you make it, yes.
I figured by the time I play, I'll get songs, you know? Like, so he said, okay. And I don't even think he asked me to audition or anything. I don't remember, but he might have asked me to do a poem or something. But I was like a comedian in a way, because my poems were bawdy and dirty, and I'd tell my little rap in between, I'd made people laugh. And, you know, once you get that reaction, how much you love it as a performer. So I found myself a 17-year-old pianist, very religious, not, I don't know, religious, but a strict Jewish, good upbringing young man, classical pianist, beautiful piano playing. Well, I asked him if he would help me write three songs. And I don't think he had ever written any songs himself. And so we wrote Luna Tuna, which is a song about how I wish I could sing. If only I could carry a tune, I would sing. But I wrote that as a song, so that's how I'd get away with it. If I sang it terribly, it was supposed to be because I'm a terrible singer.
Right.
I wrote Luna Tuna. I forgot the other two, not important. But so I got the gig as Holly Woodlawn's opening act from January 7th to 11th, I think it was. It was like a lucky, it was right on New Year's. It was a lucky number. Maybe it was 7th to 11th, yeah. And what was that, 1974,
probably. 70, maybe 74, 75.
Yeah, it was before that. Yeah. It was before. Oh, yeah. I don't know. Anyway, you'll find out. I had to look it up myself when I wrote my book.
Was it opening night that Mick and David came to see you?
Yeah, Mick and David came.
Yes.
And I got a table. And, of course, that's because I, you know, begged them to come down. Of course, when Holly Woodlawn, bless her soul, wrote her book, she didn't mention me. She mentioned
they came to see her.
It's typical drag queen. I accepted it. It's okay. But yeah, they came and they saw Holly's whole act. Well, you know, so they did see her. And then I came on because we had two shows a night. So I came on and then she went on and they came in while she was on. And then I did my act and then they left before she came on again. But they had already seen her. So, yeah, we took that one little shot in the dressing room with, I have so much makeup on because I was like on stage doing cabaret. I look ridiculous. I have so much makeup on. And it was the dressing room fluorescent lighting was terrible. This is the only picture I have with Mick and David next to me. Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, and it's not you, not your favorite look.
Not for me. It looks, I look, talk about drag queen. I look like a drag queen who didn't know how to do makeup all that well, you know, but whatever. That's what I look like. And it's stage makeup. You know, in those days we used to think stage makeup was, you know, heavy, heavy, baby.
Oh, yeah. The pancake makeup. And yes.
Oh boy. Anyway.
We can't escape without talking about the punk rock era. You said that in like 1976, you noticed that there was a new sound that was happening, sort of a stripped down sound in New York. And it was Cream magazine that dubbed it punk, right? The magazine, and you worked at Cream, right?
I think so. I mean, there was a magazine itself called Punk.
Oh, right. Okay.
I don't know if that was just in New York City, though. That might have been just local, but there was an existing magazine called Punk, but it might have been Cream was the first kind of magazine. Again, when I was writing my book, I had to look all that stuff up, and now I forget again because I don't.
Right, but the interesting thing is that the New York scene, it wasn't competitive really. Everybody sort of felt like they were in it together, and. Do you agree with that? That when you were sort of coming up in that everybody at CBGB's, and it wasn't nasty in a way that maybe the London scene was.
Well, right, it wasn't as political and it wasn't as serious, and it was a pose, and we knew it. And a lot of people had already been in like underground theater, so a lot of people had already done theater, and theater. As I said in my book, from all the different things I've done, theater is the most giving, diplomatic, democratic, beautiful working atmosphere I've ever been in, because everybody is in it for the final outcome, for the play. And you're doing your part, but you can't be competitive. You do your part the best you can, whether you're the maid or the king. And you play that part as best you can for the good of the play, so that everybody else can be good and the play can be a hit. So the punk scene in New York had a lot of people that came from that. So we still had that element of sharing and doing it for the good of all. But it was a little more competitive because musicians were more competitive. And it was a little more competitive than the theater scene. But there still was. I mean, I remember Debbie Harry, for instance, she's the only one who had a car. So she gave people rides, and she carried people's, you know, amps for them in her car, if you ask. You know, and very few people had a van. If they did, they would share it. And, you know, people would get their family and friends to come see the. There was the camaraderie to some respect. It was a beautiful balance because there was a little competition for the rock and roll, but there was the camaraderie with the theater aspect. I loved it. It was a wonderful moment. But everybody wanted to go to London.
Well, you mentioned that the minute you heard Anarchy in the UK, the Sex Pistols, that was it. You needed to get over there and see what the hell was going on in London, because that seemed like it was the epicenter of the world right then.
Yeah. There was a strength that came from that, you know. I am an antichrist. I mean, I never heard anybody on a record like that. You know, I was like, what? What is that? It was so powerful that I was like, Lee Childers was already over there managing the Heartbreakers. And he kept calling me and saying, you got to get over here. This is a scene. It's happening. It's history. And when I heard that opening lines of Anarchy for the UK, I said, okay, let's just sell everything and get some plane tickets and go over there. And that's what we did. And when I had the sale in my apartment, people stole me blind. They stole jewelry.
As they do. It always happens.
And all we did was get some one-way tickets to London, you know. But I don't regret anything. It was great. But the scene in New York at that moment was pretty fabulous, too, you know.
So when you get to London, Jane is there, Lee is there, and you are performing around town, like what, Camden Palace, maybe? I don't remember some of the places. But and everybody spits. That's how they show their appreciation. The punks spit on you, which is so disgusting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was when we were at the Roxy. I mean, there's those 100 nights at the Roxy or something. We had just gotten off the plane, I think, that morning or something. We were jet lagged, but Tony Ingrassia insisted on taking us out to see the Roxy, and we saw the Slits. I met the Slits. Mm. I love the girls in the Slits.
Oh, that's fun.
I love them. Yeah, we went to a bar nearby and had a drink with them. It was really fun. But right away, I realized when you went in order to go into the club, you had to go down this one staircase, this one entrance. And people were just sitting, filling in every spot of it. And I was like, oh, my God. And it seemed so far down into the basement. And I went like, oh, my God, this is a fire trap, you know. That's the first thing I thought of. The Roxy, like, oh, my God, I want to get out of here because this is a fire trap, you know. And, of course, a week later, I was playing in it, you know.
Your backup people was Sting and Stuart Copeland.
Oh, when I first went over there, yeah, Miles Copeland, Stuart's brother, is the one who asked me to come over. But I couldn't afford to bring everybody, so I just brought my guitarist and keyboard player, Zeka and Louie. So Miles said, I have a band and I can't get them bookings because they don't have the publicity hooks that you have. And that was Stuart Copeland on drums and Sting on the bass. And they had a guitar player named Henry Padovani at the time, Corsican guy. And so that was my band when I first went over there. And that's who we played the Roxy with and everything.
Were they fun boys? Were they serious? What was young Sting like?
He already had a huge ego, which you need to be a star in show business. You need to have it early on, I think.
Makes sense, sure.
He already had a huge ego. He already knew he was good at what he did. He was a fabulous bass player and composer. But at the time, he was composing I don't want no dead-end job, you know, like punk rock music. He hadn't really gotten into the reggae kind of thing yet, as far as I heard anyway. But he developed all of that. And then Stuart played drums. And Stuart had a funny personality, whereas, I don't know, I never went to like serious college. I just studied things at night. But Stuart had what I would imagine is like a prep school, college boy sense of humor. And for some reason, I never found what he was saying funny. So I had a kind of strained relationship with Stuart. And of course, my players used to constantly complain that Stuart Copeland, the great Stuart Copeland, didn't keep time well as a drummer. But, you know, that's the competitiveness of musicians. So, and I think there were times when, you know, maybe he did drift a little. So did I, but whatever.
But you're traveling around and you're staying like in really just flea bag hotels and you're in like a broken down van. I mean, it must have, you're really living the punk rock life with the Sting and Stuart and the rest of the gang. But it's got to have been sort of exhilarating at the same time. It was sort of probably one of the best times of your life, I imagine.
Well, of course, I had already been an advertising lady traveling on expense accounts, staying in good hotels.
Oh, right. So it felt very different.
Dinner at the best restaurants. You know, I had already tasted the good life. But I knew what I was getting into. And, you know, I looked at everything in life like playing another part. I was just playing another part. And this went along with it. This is what the direction on the script said, you know. And we money was a huge problem, and we just did the best we could. And, you know, I wouldn't change anything. I mean, there were moments when I felt real heartache, real pain, real physical pain, real physical discomfort, mental discomfort. I mean, there were times I went on stage and came off, you know, crying because I thought, oh, God, how could I be so terrible? How could I have forgotten all the lyrics? How could I have been singing the wrong song to the what you were playing?
But I imagine that's just that's sort of the charm, isn't it? Is it that sort of like you never know what you're going to get when Jerry gets on stage?
That's it. You know, and there were times when like we gelled, when I was like, oh my God, that was the highest I've ever felt. You know, when we had like a couple of minutes there where it was so in the pocket, you know, we were all so in tune with each other, the band and me, that was a thrill beyond thrill. And that's what kept you going, you know, with those moments. You kept for those moments.
I mean, we could keep going on it. I mean, there's so much more. There's Vangelis. There's, you know, your friendship with Rufus Wainwright. There's so many things that I want to talk about, but we have gone a little bit over now. So I'm going to end it there. But it's been such a pleasure talking to you. I really I've enjoyed every minute of it. Like I said, if you haven't read the book, Lick Me, get it now. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you get your books.
Get Freak Show while you're at it. 2 for 1.
And buy Freak Show while you're at it, too.
It's so good. You're such a great storyteller. I could just listen. Like, I'm totally bummed. We need to do more.
Yeah, but you guys inspire by your questions. James St. James happens to be very good at this because he's a writer. I'm good at asking people questions, too. So I know, you know, it takes a writer, James. And I love your movie, by the way, and your book.
Thank you.
We need to do a whole season with you. Because I feel we've just started.
Make it a series for Netflix and make it documentary, an ongoing documentary. Cherry Vanilla Confessions. Bye, love. Bye. Hope to see more of you.